Welcome to the 21st episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chatter.
Mahendra Singh Dhoni approves of a bit of chit-chat, so we hope he'd approve of Reverse Rep Radio.
And there's a lot to chit-chat about this week. As we speak, Pakistan are starting a dramatic and possibly historic run chase against Sri Lanka, needing 160-odd in...
They've got 20 overs to get 168. It could be fun. I mean, it probably won't be, but it could be fun.
Yeah.
It's been quite a fun test, this match, actually. Mainly because you've got a Pakistan team where the game there is being horribly dragged through the mud was the phrase I was looking for. I was going to carried through the muck, but that definitely wasn't
carried
what I wanted.
Carried through the muck works as well.
and actually, it's a real testament to how resilient, at least, the playing 11 is.
It's a testament to how resilient they are. There are so many things going on in this game. So it's being played in Abu Dhabi. We were just flicking through some pictures on Crick Info, trying to see, because we couldn't get attendance figures. So we thought we'd sort of count up the number of people we saw in the pictures, and we saw precisely zero spectators.
Analysis suggests that no one has, in fact,
watched this.
It does seem a bit odd. We don't sort of want to get too far into this, but this whole playing in Abu Dhabi, I mean, it's obviously a political necessity because of what's going on in Pakistan, but it's not entirely clear whether it's achieving anything in terms of spreading
I'm not sure what the cricket following is like in Abu Dhabi. Maybe we should do a field trip to go out there and
find out.
From the field.
The player who's made me most happy so far in this game has been Taufik Umar, who made a double hundred, which is in no way putting down, you know, Sangakkara's brilliant double hundred. But Taufik Umar, from the little I've seen of him, looks a fairly limited batsman. That sounds like a fairly harsh thing to say. You know, he's not a great stroke maker, but he made a kind of just bloody-minded stubborn 200.
It was a very good test innings.
That test cricket should really be about.
And actually, it's the kind of innings that we don't see enough from Pakistan.
Exactly. Pakistan is sort of the team that have a trademark on the word kind of mercurial, and also actually the word maverick. They're you know, the standard journalist
cliches. They're the French rugby side.
Of the cricket world. And yet, actually, it was the kind of innings that put them in a fantastic position in this game. You know, it was slow, it was painstakingly slow, but it put them in a position where really, well, unless something extraordinary happens now, the game will be a draw, but it put them in a fantastic position. You've been impressed with, the new Mohammed Amir. Is it wrong to call him that? It's
probably Khan's five for on him. on his test debut. I've been out of the country for the last week. I flew back yesterday, so I haven't actually seen any of this. But it's certainly I mean, obviously the 5-for-1 test debut speaks for itself. But one of the things that's been most worrying about, there have been lots of worrying things about the trials going on in England at the moment about the Pakistan match fixing and spot fixing. But one of the greatest concerns was that a generation of Pakistani fast bowlers had been wiped out with Asif and Amir. And so it's really good to see him, to see Khan stepping up and filling that void.
And it is interesting because the game in Pakistan is not particularly professionally run. And there was something very interesting a week or so ago where Zahir Khan came out and said India isn't going about developing fast bowlers in the right way. And you think of how the finances India have got, and you think whatever is wrong with Pakistani cricket, they do have a wonderful ability to come up with fast bowlers.
This guy's
come in and he's bowled in conditions that are frankly not particularly helpful and has done extremely well.
Well, I wonder whether the other thing that might have helped him slightly has been the Sri Lankan batting.
Or lack of.
As far as I can tell, there's been a little bit of a sort of sense of deja vu from the Australia series, which just passed in Sri Lanka. They don't have, and actually a bit of deja vu back to the India side in England, which is Sri Lanka lack real bowling ability and variety, particularly on a pitch which seems to be a flat.
I would argue that their bowling lineup is currently the least inspiring in Test cricket. I mean, I think they really are lacking in any kind of. They're lacking in a stand-up pace bowler. They're lacking, frankly, in a class.
They're lacking something. They're also lacking that sort of something slightly different. That person you can bring on when nothing's really happening. mix things up a bit.
It's not that long ago since Sri Lanka were actually playing a test series against India. I'm thinking either last year or the year before, where had they won it, they could have become the test number one side. Yep. And it's amazing sort of how quickly their
stock's fallen. That seems a long way away now, doesn't it? But I think what's happening to Sri Lanka at the moment, which is possibly what happened to India over the summer, is that because their bowling isn't able to ever put them in a match-winning situation, the pressure is all on their batting.
Mm.
And actually, this is, on paper, a pretty good Sri Lankan batting lineup.
Well, that but they have consistently,
both against Australia and here against Pakistan, they have consistently failed to put themselves in a dominant position in the first innings with the bat. I mean, they're fine. It's all right saving the game in the second innings when Sangakkara comes along and makes a double century. But they just seem to be unable to take a real grip of the game as it starts.
Well, we will be following that with interest if Pakistan do something that I think you'd fairly say definitely unprecedented. Over to India, where England have already lost the one-day series.
It didn't take long.
I mean, for me, about the most exciting thing that's happened here from an England perspective has been that innings by Samit Patel yesterday, 70-odd off 43 balls. And it's interesting because Samit Patel came into the England side with this reputation from county cricket as being a big hitter. Yep. He's never done it. You look back at his previous records, he's never played this kind of an innings.
He's more often just looked a little bit bewildered against good bowling in the international arena.
Yeah, and he's just kind of... It's funny, when a player has that reputation of being a big hitter and you suddenly look at their scores and you think, well, he's never actually done it. Mm. And he's kind of... I think it's been the innings that's taken him from... And this might sound a bit extreme, but it's taken him from kind of... A sort of hanger-on, you know, one of those players who's in the squad consistently, but you don't quite feel they've merited it. You don't quite feel
they haven't cemented. He had never cemented his place.
Exactly. I think he's done enough, and it sounds maybe a lot of one innings, but I think that has really bought him a lot of time now, because England lack players who can do that.
Patel will benefit from actually having a secure spot in the side, because he seems to be one of those people who doesn't thrive on the, oh, I'm going to lose my place if I don't play well scenario. Which brings the best out of some players, but for him, I think actually being in the side and having a secure place
It's not particularly pleasant having your weight constantly discussed by newspapers. I mean, your love of KFC being brandished on the...
Exactly.
I mean, do you think Alistair Cook, you know, England's new one-day captain, has got a strategy for how England should play on the subcontinent?
Well, I think he's got a bit of a problem on his hands, actually, because he... So I was trying to think this morning what this side has lacked in this series. And one of the things it seems to have lacked is the sort of spontaneity and captaincy that I don't think Strauss has. I think the last thing the captain to really have it was Michael Vaughan. Alistair Cook doesn't seem to be able to sort of really respond to a game as it's happening and do something completely crazy and sort of try things out. That doesn't seem to be able to happen. And what has been quite worrying for England is that things have sort of... I mean, it's difficult to put your finger on what's happening, but there have been drop catches. I mean, that appalling Kiesewetter missed run-outs in the...
I think there's a real sense in which the roles have reversed, actually, from India being in England to England being in India, in that the sloppy fielding characterised India's tour to England. And England suddenly look a bit worn out. They just don't look that up for this series. And I just wonder if it's a question of overkill, of too much cricket, and frankly, of too much India.
Yeah.
You know, they've had a whole summer against them.
I mean, it is difficult, actually, to see this as a completely new series. I mean, because it's so close to the last series over the summer.
It's
kind of just a continuation of that. And as so often happens for England in one days that sort of come after the main event, they just slump completely.
And it's hard to know how worried you should get as an England fan about this sort of minor outbreak of kind of dissent. You know, there was Tim Breslin's been fined for snatching his cap too vigorously.
Isn't cricket a wonderful game?
Jane Jernback finally had enough of Kiesewetter's various drops and had a bit of a go at him. That kind of indiscipline is something we haven't seen from England for a while.
It's not. And what's I think might be slightly worrying is that just as in the past, we've always lamented that England's test success hasn't filtered down to the one-day side. Now that the one-day and the test side are closer in terms of personnel than they've ever been before, there must be a worry that if the one-day side is badly off the boil, that it'll affect the test side as well. So, from the archives, and as Australia tour South Africa, we're looking back to the first Australia tour of South Africa after South Africa came back from the international wilderness in the early 1990s. This is a game which happened at Johannesburg in March 1994, and it happened at a very interesting point for a number of reasons. Firstly, you have this sort of lost generation of South African cricketers who finally, in the early 1990s, are able to come onto the international scene and have to make their mark before they, you know, before they retire.
And you've also got a couple of exciting young names coming through, haven't you?
Exactly.
You've got sort of Rhodes, Cronje, Alan Donald. Exactly, who are on their way,
well,
in hindsight, to becoming household names
in the 90s. But you've also got the likes of Craig Matthews, who we'll be hearing a lot more about later, and Kepler Vassals, who are towards the end of their international career. This wasn't the first test series between the sides. There'd been a series in Australia, which had been drawn 1-1, including a thrilling test, which South Africa won by 5 runs, with one Shane Warne, also at the beginning of his career, taking 12 wickets. What's interesting about the series that we're looking at today is that there was a setup which we don't really see anymore, which is that the tests came not before or after a one-day series, but in the middle of a one-day series. So that when the test series started, South Africa were already up 3-1 in the one-days.
In the sense that they've got some momentum, I suppose, even with
exactly,
different formats.
Exactly.
But
rather nicely, rather symmetrically, by the end of both the test series and the one-days, well, the test series was drawn 1-1 and the one-days were drawn 4-1. But today we're looking at the
Exactly. So South Africa win the toss and they decide to have a bat, and they lose Andrew Hudson early on, but Kirsten and Cronje rebuild fairly successfully, get South Africa up to 70-odd. There's then a kind of a steady fall of wickets after Cronje falls, and at 126/6, you feel like South Africa are actually in danger of, well, not possibly a humbling, actually,
yep.
here.
Yep.
And it's Jonty Rhodes, the young Jonty Rhodes, who leads the fight back. It's interesting, actually, looking back at his record as a test batsman, because for his reputation...
His reputation is as a fielder.
That's how everyone knows. I read something the other day. No South African sportsman has ever had as many endorsements as Jonty Rhodes. His reputation, not just inside cricket but outside, you know, in sport as a whole, is huge. But it's interesting, you actually look at his test stats, only ever made 3 test hundreds. But anyway, here very much
wasn't much of a bowler, actually, to be honest, either.
No. In fact, I'd love to know how many balls he ever delivered at test level. Probably a handful. But here he makes a very a key innings, makes 69 and helps South Africa to a respectable 251. One sort of slightly interesting bit of captaincy here from Alan Border. He waits 49 overs before giving Shane Warne a bowl, which just seems interesting here, given that... they were struggling to remove Rhodes,
and particularly because Warne had been so destructive in that series before in Australia.
Exactly,
taking a 7-for and a 5-for, I think it was.
It does seem a strange kind of unimaginative captaincy. Australia's reply is fairly unimpressive. Steve Waugh top scores with 45, but lots and lots of the Aussies make a start but fail to go on,
including one Matthew Hayden, who's making his debut in this match. I mean, even for the Australians, there are players sort of coming through from the beginning.
He makes a fairly indistinguished 15, doesn't he? And they don't help themselves. There's run-outs for Alan Border and Mark Waugh, who both go when actually pretty well set.
Well set, yeah.
And they finish on 248, giving the South Africans a small lead. a very tiny lead, 3 runs.
3-run lead, yeah.
Kirsten and Hudson build well, actually, for South Africa. And by the time they're both dismissed, they've given South Africa a pretty good platform, 123/2. Here, at this point, comes one of the game's most disreputable... this game's most disreputable incident.
Oh, right, sorry. I thought
the game as a whole.
Well, no. I thought you were going to go on and talk about Hanze Cronje as being... Before you said incident, I thought you were going to say people. And Hanze Cronje, who at this point was the sort of golden boy of...
Golden boy of cricket.
But we'll move on to Hanze Cronje, because there's something before.
Shane Warne, whose career could never be... You know, it was always a colourful career. Loses it with Andrew Hudson after dismissing him, swears at him and then points him on his way to his pavilion, fined £1,000 for this, and he later goes on to describe this as one of the most regrettable in his career, which, you know, brilliant career as it was, there were a fair few regrettable moments
yes,
in
exactly.
it. And you just wonder, and it was Wisden suggest in their summary of the game that perhaps his sheer frustration came from how little he was being used. He'd waited 49 well, overs in the first innings, he waited 44 overs to bowl here.
And he's bowled off both Steve and Mark Waugh, and that's not a great endorsement.
And then a 24-year-old Hansi Cronje now comes to the fold, and it's interesting how much of you know Cronje's reputation is now utterly coloured, and you know perhaps you'd say rightly so by his involvement in match fixing. At this point, as you said, you know he was the golden boy, sort of flashy number three,
as he proves here.
And he hits 122. And it's an innings that really is, apart from anything else his teammates are playing, he scores at a rate that none of them else can. And he puts South Africa in a position from which they can win the game. He departs with them on 289 for four. They eventually make their way to 450, at which point they declare. Australia are left with a pretty improbable 454 to win. They start reasonably. They get to 123 for two by the end of day four. And from that position, you think there's half a chance at least of saving the game.
Particularly as they've got, I mean, they've got a pretty... You look down their batting lineup, and it is. I mean, I suppose just like South Africa's, it's a mix of old hands and the people who have come to really characterise the 90s. So you've got Michael Slater and Matthew Hayden opening, David Boone... Mark Waugh, Alan Border, Steve Waugh, and Ian Healy. So I mean, it's a pretty.
There's enough batting there. There's enough batting there to think that they could have maybe survived that final day. In the end, the resistance is actually pretty token. I mean, Boone is the one who hangs around for a steady 83. No one else really gives him any support. The tail wags a little bit. But in the end, they dismissed for...
256. And it's good. It's an impressive all-round bowling display from the South Africans as well. Because actually, I don't think any of their bowlers actually... No, none of their bowlers take a fiver in this match. I mean, three wickets is the most any of them take. But they consistently have... Donald de Villiers, McMillan and Matthews take two and three wickets apiece.
It's interesting, isn't it, how much of a team effort it is with the ball. And also, you know, talking about the need for these South African players to prove themselves, this was a pretty significant win, you know, at the start of the series. It was very significant over an Australia team that were, you know, being taken very seriously in the World Game. They certainly weren't anywhere near their peak.
You get the sense that there's a lot of pride to play for in this match with Australia coming to South Africa. It's a home series against probably the best side in the world at that point.
It's an interesting rivalry as well. I mean, reports from this game suggest that the atmosphere in the ground was actually pretty vicious. You know, the Australians got a lot of abuse, and apparently, you know, that may well have contributed to the worn outburst as well. You know, it's not a rivalry that we instinctively see as one of cricket's most fierce.
No.
But there certainly is something.
Well, I suppose there's something added to it by the presence of Kepler Wessels, who, of course, one of the only. Is he the only? Is there another Test player? I'm sure there is another Test player who's played for two countries.
Two Test nations, but I think he's certainly in a rare company.
One of the few.
To the book review, and this week we're going to the West Indies and back to 1947 for Leary Constantine's Cricket in the Sun.
I'm massively excited about this. It's one of my favourite cricket books, and Leary Constantine is one of my favourite cricket figures. He was not only the most sort of dashing all-rounder of his day, renowned for amazing fielding, fairly vicious fast bowling and flamboyant all-out batting, but he sort of bookended his cricketing career with a very major career in politics. And in particular, he spearheaded the movement towards independence in the West Indies, or he's one of those spearheading the movement towards independence, along with C.L.R. James, who he co-wrote several books with.
It's stating the obvious, but for the quality of a cricket biography, cricket autobiography, will always come down to the ability of that cricketer to reflect on the game, to think about the game. And you kind of get the impression almost instantly that Constantine is a thinker, you know, that he's able not just to have tell his life story, but to really consider
it. Exactly. I mean, he was the first High Commissioner in London from the West Indies when the West Indies gained independence in 1962. He worked for the BBC, and he was a very prominent political activist. So yeah, he certainly was a thinker. He's certainly not the kind of Nasser Hussain model of play cricket, go into cricket commentary in the Sky Sports box, and that's it. He has, throughout this book, and actually what's so significant about this book, which was published in 1947, is that it actually begins to think about, one of the first books to begin thinking about cricket in the context of politics in a really serious way.
I mean, from a sort of just purely from the playing perspective, you do get an impression of just an astonishingly talented cricketer. I mean, I love the way how he sort of plays down his achievements. You know, he'll take 7 wickets one day, he'll hold a stunning catch the next. I think he was an all-rounder in the truest sense.
Oh,
I mean, it's quite interesting how he talks about the need to learn to become a cover point fielder. I sometimes think that's something maybe we've lost a little bit in the game, the idea that there are certain fielding positions that you don't just go and stand there and make the most of it. You know, that actually it's an art, in the same way that it's bowling.
It's an art, but it's also a trade. So Constantine goes over and plays. Having grown up in the West Indies, he gets signed for Nelson Cricket Club in the Lancashire League. Apologies for Andy's
squeaky chair.
Goes and plays for Nelson in the Lancashire League, where he, you know, is the professional, is playing cricket constantly. And actually, that in itself throws up some interesting questions, because he's actually prevented from playing international cricket for the West Indies occasionally,
and we
because
consider,
he's playing in the Lancashire League.
And we consider these sort of club versus country conflicts often to be new. We consider it often to be a creation of the IPL, don't we? This issue of, you know, I think a lot of people got very upset that Sehwag played for the in the IPL, got himself injured.
We're used to it in football, but we're not used to it in cricket.
No, and I mean, it's interesting because at the time, he came under heavy criticism, and he admits this in the book, for taking sort of money over country. So that accusation has been around.
Although it has to be said that he was contracted to play for Nelson, and it was Nelson's decision whether or not he could be released.
But it also says something extraordinary about the power of league cricket at the time. I mean, part of the reason they really wouldn't release him was that they were getting these staggering attendances. You know, the number of people who they were talking about thousands coming to watch Constantine play, and, you know, obviously coming to watch Nelson play. But it's interesting that that dilemma, you know, is something that isn't new.
And it's also something about the status of the amateur within, or sort of, well, the professional, but the badly played professional within cricket. Because there's a lot of, Constantine was one of the most successful cricketers throughout the world of his day. I mean, there's a great anecdote you were talking about earlier where a club offers both him and Bradman contracts, but offers Constantine more money than they offer Bradman. That's a signal of how highly he was held.
But the book starts with him facing a genuine dilemma of, do I become a professional cricketer or do I become a clerk in a law firm? And you actually realise that, you know, his father really encourages him, despite his ability, to go into the law firm, to really see cricket as play.
Yeah.
And it makes you very aware that the ability to play sport as a profession is kind of a privilege that, you know, talented sportsmen haven't had for the
and it has some interesting implications for the success of the West Indies side as well, because they talk about when they go down to Australia, and it's actually the series in which they win for the first ever time against Australia. It's a match we've actually looked at like a few episodes ago in Reverse Web Radio. The captain, who is, and the West Indies always had a white captain, and the captain is sort of flown in from straight from Britain and has hardly met any of the players before.
Is he flown in from Cambridge University?
Yeah, I think so. And the team has hardly played together, and you get the sense of a completely shambolic setup, which in a sense is an entirely dissimilar setup nowadays.
I know, and this idea that also that He talks very, quite vividly, actually, of the traumas of actually, not the traumas, the trials of trying to live on tour with very little money. Mm. He has a quite funny story where he talks about taking a girl out to the cinema and suddenly realising that he doesn't really have enough money to get her home afterwards. And he compares it to how much the other countries are being paid, the other test players of the other nations. And again, it's something that sort of rings true today. I mean, this whole match-fixing scandal.
Exactly. There are several areas that he comments on within the game, and he sort of, the book is punctuated by his ideas for how
he has a manifesto for change, doesn't he? He has a genuine program for reforming the game, almost not in its entirety, but very boldly.
What were the bits that you that caught your eye, the suggestions?
Well, the one I have to, not one I agree with, but certainly the one that goes down as by distance the most revolutionary, his kind of extraordinary suggestion to set a time limit on how long a batsman should be allowed before getting to 50 runs. So Constantine, and he loves to use the phrase, I went in and knocked them about. Mm. That was the Constantine approach to batting. Yep. And you get the feeling he has less and less patience the Taufik Umars of this world, who sort of will take the time. And so that was that was an idea that I'm sure the 2020 would sort of buy into in a massive way.
So he was suggesting that you would be dismissed unless you scored at a set run rate.
He also suggests getting rid of any first innings points in county cricket, just encouraging captains to be that little bit bolder, which is something that we're still talking about today. Yep. So, a lot of it is very prescient.
But what's interesting, though, from the perspective of this book, is that actually you realise that he's being slightly contradictory in a lot of it. And he, so whilst he always talks about the need to get in, I mean, he's very sort of on the ball in terms of too many metaphors flying around, on the ball in terms of realizing that people want to see entertainment. Mm. And so he says that batsmen have to score more quickly and you get them out if they're not scoring quickly enough. But there are moments when he also says he realizes that often the point of a game against a county side ahead of a test series isn't to win. Sometimes it's to take out a particular bowler or to demoralize a particular batsman, etc., etc. And there's a time he talked about when he commanded this batsman a day and a half out from the end of a county game to play for a draw. I think you have to take with a little bit pinch of salt.
His view of cricket as entertainment, he actually makes a direct comparison with football. He actually at one point talks specifically about the crowds that come in for football, the crowds that come in for cricket. And he genuinely muses over whether 3-day, 4-day cricket has a future.
It's too long.
Which again, at this time, in 1947, is kind of a long way ahead.
Yeah, no, it's very fast.
He has a lot to say about body line. That comes up again and again, both from personal experience on the receiving end of it and delivering it.
Mm, he does.
And reflections on, I guess, that notorious series.
Exactly. Bodyline is sort of around and about from the late 20s onwards. There's actually, obviously, the most famous, the infamous series is in 1933, but then the West Indies go to England shortly after that. Well, I can't remember if it's in the West Indies, but anyway, England play the West Indies shortly after that, and the West Indies are accused of bowling bodyline. He has some interesting thoughts on it. What did you
think? Well, he's got some interesting anecdotes. There's one in particular where he's asked politely by the England captain of the day to sort of stop bowling bodyline, and he kind of feels it's a slightly odd request. Mm. And then the West Indies go out to bat and quickly find themselves confronted with bodyline bowling. So there was a sort of odd, you get this very sort of strange sense that a lot of teams were using it and then spending their time getting upset about other teams using it. Mm. I rather like this sort of little anecdote, when Wally Hammond was batting against bodyline and complained about it. So young Wally didn't like it and complained. Lord Tennyson, the England captain, told him to shut up and bat, which he did very well.
Yeah.
And I think Constantine's basic riposte to bodyline is, if you're a good batsman, you will knock it around. And it's quite a sort of, refreshingly simple but straightforward.
It is, and it's nice actually to have another, because we're very used to hearing the sort of England-Australia line, the Jack Fingleton perspectives, that kind of thing. And it's nice to have a completely different perspective on it. So, on to the debate, and this week we're asking whether the Pakistan spot-fixing trial is refreshing or depressing.
It's been kind of intriguing to watch. You know, every day you've had a new sort of titillating revelation. I kind of feel like this is the only way cricket gets a fresh start. So to that extent, I think it is refreshing. Justice of some sort is being done here. I think the main accusation you could make is that this is far from comprehensive justice.
Well, it's not that it's just far from comprehensive justice. It's that it's depressing in so many ways. Firstly, because so many new allegations are being thrown up. And yes, it's a good thing that these things are coming to light. But you get the sense with Majid, this agent who's accused of collaborating with Butt and Asif and Amir, that he is basically a complete nutcase. And whether what he's saying is true or not, the fact that he has accused both the Australians, kind of generally, I've sort of said every single Australian who's ever played cricket has been corrupt, but also he's accused the likes of Wasim and Waqar Yunus and Moin Khan of match fixing as well.
Fear here is that that all cricket fans share is that this is not isolated. I think the greatest terror is that this is a kind of tip of some very rotten iceberg.
Yeah, well, whether or not that is true, what has essentially been allowed to happen is that Majid is basically just dragging cricket's name through the mud.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that things should be brushed under the carpet at all. But he's just got a soapbox, man. He's just mouthing off. And the whole thing is just making the game look stupid. And mostly that's because it is stupid. I mean, some of the, like Salman Butt, when he said that he brought $8,000 in cash in a suitcase to the UK in order to buy a watch. I mean, what's wrong with your credit card? And similarly, why he had a massive pile of SIM cards in his hotel room. And he said it was cheaper to have multiple SIM cards.
The defence has been consistently entertaining. I mean, depressingly entertaining, perhaps. But Majid does appear to be a fantasist. I mean, if you take away the fact that, you know, he clearly seems to have been caught in the act here, comments such as he was close friends with Roger Federer, that he secured a £12 million book deal for Rio Ferdinand, he clearly makes a lot of stuff up. Yeah. It actually appears to be the only success the defence has had, is that showing that Majid is slightly crazy. It's not always been pleasant to watch, but these players are being humiliated in front of a global audience. And painful as that is for them and perhaps for Pakistani cricket, it is what cricket needs.
What I worry about is that so they are humiliated, they are shown as having been part of it, these accusations, you know, maybe some other cricketers are shown, maybe a couple of Australians are shown up having done spot fixing. But I think that it's just so much deeper than that, that one criminal trial in England, all it's going to do is just make the game look silly. It's not actually going to
I would suggest that the more that comes out, the greater the sense of urgency will be both amongst fans and the ICC to act very harshly against this. I mean, I agree with you. We really don't have a sense of how... I mean, Majid's comments about the Australians, I think we have to take it with a pinch of salt. And I think the Australians are rightly very sort of offended by it. But I think it would not surprise, I mean, and again, this is, it would not surprise many of us, I don't think, that if this was quite endemic within, especially Pakistani cricket, I think if we were going back years and found that this was happening again and again, I don't think that would surprise. I mean, hopefully it will act as a genuine deterrent to players, that seeing the what this has done to Butt's career, what this has done to Asif's career.
But wouldn't people have been saying that this after Tanzi Konya was, you know, was disgraced?
I
don't think that if the arguments about why this is happening, which are Pakistani cricketers aren't paid enough, that it's endemic within the game, that the management presumably are in some sense involved. If that all stands, then I don't think the deterrent of one trial is enough. Mm. Particularly if there are other people who are getting away with it, then actually that's as much of an incentive. You know, one trial isn't fair enough if everyone who had ever done it.
I think it's perhaps. I mean, I would agree entirely. I think one of the most depressing things is the fact, and I think this was particularly depressing in the case of the young Amir, is that you've clearly got members of the management who were aware of this. You are not telling fans seriously that Majid's access to the team and access to these players went unnoticed by management. So it's a tragedy that some of those people are not on trial or not punished themselves. The reality is, you know, it was never going to be perfect, perhaps. We were never going to get the dream trial where everybody... And I think, I can't help feeling that this is better than nothing. Mm. I mean, I do think that in terms of the deterrent, I accept your point. I mean, Cronje's career, the way that was ruined, obviously should have acted as a very strong deterrent. Perhaps there does need to be a focus on this issue of payment. I mean, maybe in terms of a long-term solution here... this issue of how much Pakistani cricketers are played, and perhaps not just Pakistani cricketers, but we're looking at all the test nations where the pay isn't that considerable compared to the money that can be made through this. Maybe that is the only long-term solution.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. And it's just, I mean, I just suppose I feel there's something slightly sordid, maybe, about the way that these... So the most recent accusations about Majid coming out... a drinks breaks during the tests and shaking hands with the players with a bit of Vaseline in his hand, and they get the Vaseline so that they can tamper with the ball with some Vaseline. I mean, it just seems as if he's being allowed to. And if these things are true, then obviously they should come to light. But it just seems that he's being allowed just a platform from which to just sort of badmouth anyone and everything within cricket.
As an aside, I just find it fascinating how some of these Pakistani cricketers were able to go out and perform day in, day out during that series. Yeah. I mean, the sort of pressure they were under, the kind of difficulties they were under, are such that to actually focus on the game amongst all of that was almost quite an achievement. Thank you for listening again. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with an excitingly revamped show. If you've got anything you'd like to tell us about the programme, any stuff that you love, any stuff that you can't stand, then get in touch with us. Either email us at reverseswept@gmail.com, or we have now entered the crazy world of Twitter, where we can be found at reverseswept.
Reverseswept.
Is that all you need to know to get on the
Twitter? Just reverseswept.com/reverseswept. Next time, we'll be seeing whether England can salvage a little bit of pride against India. We'll be following that Sri Lanka and Pakistan series, and we'll be seeing how New Zealand get along against the Zimbabwe.